You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 23rd of August 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com tonight. Because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the three Masonic victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing, sir? How are you?
Doing okay. Been working on the closing credits this week of Masonic and the music. So been fairly busy.
Excellent stuff. If I remember rightly, the episode with the credits, it takes up a whole episode, doesn't it, doing the credits?
Usually, yeah.
Yeah, you're pretty painstaking with that, aren't you? You tend to find absolutely every source that you can for all the information that you've put in there. Is that right?
Yeah, painstaking is the word, because it is laborious, but I feel necessary.
And is there going to be another actual episode of action before we see the credits?
I think before the credits, what I'm going to do is a rake of conclusions of what each episode actually found out.
As you sort of go back over everything and just remind people of it.
Yeah,
it'd probably be good if we do an episode doing that of Truthful Out Radio as well. Well, we've got some really interesting stuff for tonight, I think, and it will probably go on over the next two or three episodes, I think, looking at some quotes from the people that were in the dock at the Nuremberg trials. Now, you sent this over to me, Dennis. Is it one of your regular listeners that sent you that, or did you just find it looking through the internet?
No, this is one of my regular people who send me various things every now and again.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. There was two booklets there. The first one was about Adolf Hitler claiming that he was Jesus Christ, which I thought was a little bit suspect. I think it was written just after the war, and
by someone in England.
Yeah, he's an English author, and I think some of it was relying on black propaganda more than original information. Because I don't think that, the National Socialists didn't see Hitler as Christ.
That
was sort of a blasphemy. That was more Shivitri Devi later on with her esoteric Hitlerism sort of thing. But the second one that you sent over, that had all these really, really interesting quotes from the people that were in the dock, stuff that we haven't heard of before. So I thought we could go through those and discuss what they're talking about. Go on.
A lot of these, of course, I'd heard about in the book, A Requiem for Hitler, which is where I first heard about Hitler getting the Requiem Mass, which again, adds more evidence to him being, the chosen protector of Europe by the Vatican. They actually gave him a Requiem Mass after he was announced dead. A lot of these socialists who maybe were not totally Christian during, the lives at the end, before they were about to be hung, came out with some significant statements. And true to the course, Wikipedia now denies that there was a Requiem Mass and uses a certain person, can't remember his name, who goes on to say that it never happened. But they always will do.
Do you want to just fill us in on what a Requiem Mass is for the non-Catholic listeners?
Yeah, it's for people of real importance who have died without the chance of the sacraments given to them and the last confession, which most Catholics ask for. Hitler wouldn't have had that opportunity, and so he was obviously therefore qualified for a Requiem Mass.
Would that be for anyone that doesn't get the last rites, or is it just for very important people like kings?
I think it's more for the more important, to be quite honest, because I presume there's millions around who die without that last confession.
So you're sort of on a par with monarchs, maybe, or heads of state?
Possibly a little bit lower.
Okay. Well, that's important stuff. I mean, it's really what you're just going to expect, isn't it? That Wikipedia are going to try and obscure that. But it's...
Well, they did the same with when I found the evidence of the Russian attempt to invade Europe. I mean, I found all the evidence and, you know, all the papers and who signed them on Wikipedia, which I put in the documentary Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story. And then that was suddenly removed, and now they call it a myth.
Well, there was also a speech by Goebbels to the party rally in 1936, and that is pointing out this build-up of troops in the Soviet Union with the plan of invading Europe. And he points all this out in 1936 at this huge rally. I came across the English version of the speech the other day, and I thought, well, that backs that up as well. They knew about it then. They were planning of defending Europe from this way back then, 1936, years before it actually became necessary for them to actually do that. Well, these quotes are particularly interesting because they show us that what we've been saying is true, basically. And the people that were accused of these terrible things in the dock, they didn't go along with it. They didn't accept what they were told. They could tell that it was ridiculous. And the first one that we'll look at is Hermann Göring. And before we get into his quotes, I had a look on Wikipedia just to see if I could pull up a few bits of information that people might not be aware of. And he was a highly decorated Air Force veteran. In World War One, in addition to his Iron Crosses, first and second class, he received the Zahringer Lion with swords, the Friedrich Order, the House Order of Hohenzollern with swords, third class, and finally, in May 1918, the coveted Pour le Mérite. He finished the war with 22 victories, and a thorough post-war examination of Allied loss records showed that only two of his awarded victories were doubtful. Three were possible and 17 were certain or highly likely. And when you actually look at all the medals and awards he was given, he had tons from foreign countries. There were a lot more than that by the end of the Second War. He had he had awards from Sweden, from Holland, from all over the place. This was a man that was at the top of his class, basically. One bit people might not be aware of, Göring was appointed the Reich Minister of the Hunt in 1933 and the Master of the German Forests in 1934, which meant that he instituted reforms to the forestry laws and acted to protect endangered species. So he was trying to protect the wildlife way back then. He was trying to stop these species going extinct. Another bit that I found on Wikipedia, Göring directed anti-partisan operations by Luftwaffe security battalions in the Białowieża forest between 1942 and 1944, and they say that resulted in the murder of thousands of Jews and Polish civilians. Yet at the beginning of that sentence, they told us he was directing anti-partisan operations. That means anti-terrorist operations. So they weren't murdered, were they? It was self-defense. These were terrorists that ended up being killed. And then some final bits just about the trial itself. Not permitted to present a lengthy statement, Göring declared himself to be, in the sense of the indictment, not guilty. So he refused to go along with what they were trying to pin on him. And Göring told US psychiatrist Leon Goldenson, sounds like a Jewish name, that the court was stupid to try the little fellows like Funk and Kaltenbrunner instead of letting Göring take all the blame on himself. So that shows you that even while he was there in court, he was still standing up for the people that were beneath him and saying, let me take the blame on myself instead of going after all these little guys. They were just obeying orders. So he was loyal to the end, and he also claimed that he had never heard of most of the other defendants before the trial actually took place. So they were trying to say that they were all conspiring together, and he didn't really know them. And he also said that he had no control over the actions or the defence of others, and that he had never been anti-Semitic himself, had not believed the atrocities that they were being shown, and that several Jews had actually offered to testify on his behalf. And that came from a report from a US intelligence officer and psychologist. So not really believable that they were gassing Jews if he had Jews that were offered to testify and the court wouldn't allow them to testify. Mm. And he was also not allowed to read out a lengthy statement. He wasn't allowed to actually present a defence. He was just allowed to sort of give replies, sentence replies. He wasn't actually allowed to read out a prepared defence or a prepared statement. Probably because, you know, they couldn't allow that to happen because they knew that it would show that he was innocent of the charges against him, I guess.
Well, I think he was condemned before it actually began, so anything was standing in his favour was disregarded. I know in the documentary I cover over this, and you've got an American who was there at the time actually stating that you knew that he was a man of importance. You could, his whole presence was like a beam of light in that courtroom. You know, this was the real deal type of thing.
I used to be famous for the clothes that he wore as well. I mean, he had mm-hmm. a great style. You can even tell from the black and white pictures, this was a really, really stylish man, a true Aryan that maybe had lapsed a little bit as he got older and put on a little bit of weight. But he mm-hmm. was a real proper aristocrat, a good example of that class, I would suggest, being willing to lay down his life for the people that were beneath him. And he's quite obviously the warrior caste, I would mm-hmm. say. I'm going to start with these quotes. The first one, he says, "The victor will always be the judge and the vanquished the accused." And that's what we've been saying. This is victor's justice, isn't it?
Well, it goes a couple of steps further than World War One. I mean, in World War One, Germany didn't get their colonies back. There's usually some kind of a time period where once things have settled down, the two enemies have settled, you know, with the war being won by one side, and there's an honourable, you know, kind of exchange of things, and things get back to sort of normal. But after World War One, that wasn't the case. As we know, the Germans were starved to actually sign this death warrant of the Treaty of Versailles. This time, they went a little bit further for having the audacity to go up against this power of Jewish power. You know, there is real payback.
Well, it makes a mockery of justice as well, doesn't it? I mean, what the point that he's making there, that the victor will always be the judge and the vanquished the accused, he's saying that if Germany had won, then Germany would have been the judge and the vanquished would have been the accused. And how can that be right if justice is supposed to be something that doesn't pay attention to the person truth. Of a man yeah. or is based on truth, then that can't be right. So that's what he's saying with that quote there, is that this isn't justice. This is, you know, it's a travesty of justice to have the victor standing there accusing the person that was defending himself for defending himself, which is essentially what it was.
Yeah, the first time ever as well. Nothing like this had ever happened before throughout history.
Oh, it's a total first. And I think it's set the precedent since then as well, really, in court cases with the family law courts, where you're not allowed to enter in your own evidence. You're only allowed to use what the family courts provide, and you're not allowed to have a proper defence, basically. And I think that, mm-hmm. that this set a precedent for that. And when people are in courts and they're having their children taken from them, they're in a similar position to the accused at Nuremberg.
They have no say, yeah.
Well, the next quote from Goering, he says, "After the United States gobbled up California and half of Mexico and we were stripped down to nothing, territorial expansion suddenly becomes a crime. It's been going on for centuries and it will still go on." So what they're saying there is if it somehow becomes different when it's Germany that expands its territory by just taking in territories that belonged to it before, that suddenly becomes a crime. But it's okay for America to do that, with California yeah. and Mexico. And just in actual fact, just about every country has done that, haven't they?
Just about, yeah. I mean, I suppose it's the way of the law, isn't it? And the law of nature, in a way where, you know, people, the stronger will rule the weaker. The weaker always have a problem.
So again, it's not a crime that you can prosecute people for.
No, but they did.
And even when they were talking about the Lebensraum and they were talking about going into Russia, that wasn't really to be at the expense of Russia. I mean, Hitler was saying that this is land that isn't developed. They're living, back in the Dark Ages in a lot of these areas. Right. They're living in tin shacks. And if us Germans were to go there, we would develop the place and we would bring the technology there and the infrastructure there and the Russians' lives would be improved. Similar to... Originally, I mean, the legend has it that it was Nordic nobility that went into Russia and brought the law with them. And the Slavs asked them to go there to bring the benefits of the law and order that the Nordics actually had and to bring that with them into Russia. Now, I don't know how much truth there is to that legend, but that shows that it went on years ago and all he was doing was suggesting the same. It was more like mm-hmm. a liberation when they went into the Soviet countries.
Well, when you think about it, he's never going to write about invading a country in America, is he?
No. This is my plan for invasion.
Yeah, he's just been twisted.
He says, Hitler was our sovereign. It would be intolerable for me to have him standing before a foreign court. You men knew the Führer. He would be the first one to stand up and say, I have given the orders and I take full responsibility. But I would rather die 10 deaths than have the German sovereign subjected to such humiliation. Two things in that, I think. Again, it's this, the person at the top takes the responsibility. This isn't a democracy. He gave the orders and people had to follow. He takes the responsibility for that. And the second thing, that it was the equivalent of a German sovereign. It's like taking the king of another country and taking him to court in somebody else's country. You can't do that. You couldn't take the queen and put her on trial in another country because the queen makes the law in Britain, so the queen can't break the law in Britain. And it's the same for the state. The state in Germany made the law in Germany, so the state couldn't break the law because they made the law. That was the whole ridiculousness of this trial.
Yeah, well... Again, this was, I don't even remember that, but this was shown in the Greatest Story Never Told. It was on a break, when everybody was in what was the, I suppose, the canteen there for everybody. And this is where he came out with a statement, slammed his fist on the table and saying, I would rather die 10 deaths, which I thought was quite a poignant moment.
And it's obviously a direct quote.
Mm-hmm.
Not just something that's dramatised. He said, next to my own people, I feel closest sympathy with the English. Anyway, one thing is clear. Germany must rise either with the English or the Russians. And the Russians seem to have the upper hand. They are clever too. Fritz tells me they keep asking about me. Maybe I would be better off in their hands. And that's interesting when you think about what's happened since the war. I mean, after the war with the East German side that was actually with the Russians, and now after the war, Germany has risen again, as it were, but a sort of communist version of Germany that's tied in with the European Union.
That's true. I mean, I don't know whether it would be better with the Russians at that time, but certainly... I think he has an affinity with Britain, not so much the British elite, but the British race, the Anglo-Saxon or the Celtic race in Britain, he feels close to, as did Hitler. And so that line doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, that's a racial thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But also, yeah. I think what he's thinking about here is, there's going to be problems with the Soviets now. And Germany's either going to be on the side of the Soviets or on the side of the English. And Germany was split between both, really. As I say, with East and West Germany,
mm-hmm.
you had the East German side with the Soviets and the West German side that was with the Allies. But it did have to be one of the two. I don't think he foresaw Germany being split in two like that.
No, I think, later on he mentions like a time span where he thinks Germany will rise again, but again, nothing since has happened. Rather, it's just all been a covert attempt to force this new world order around the world eventually.
Well, they've had to do so much to cover all this up, haven't they? That's the thing. I think if the Germans knew this, then yes, they would rise up, and he was expecting them to find out. But he couldn't have foreseen Hollywood and Holocaust training in schools. He couldn't have foreseen this lie about the Holocaust. I mean, that's related to the next quote. And they actually showed them these propaganda movies that they'd made after the war. And he says, the Russian atrocity film was a fake. Lots of these pictures were probably taken during their own revolution, like the baskets of heads, those fields covered with bodies. Such pictures are easy to get any time in a war. And where did they get the fresh corpses to photograph? They couldn't have come right in ready to take pictures. They must have shot those people themselves. So he's picked up on a lot there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, after the war, as we know, a lot were sent back to the Soviet Union. Down in the Baltics, they were sent back to the communists. So there'll be plenty of fields with dead bodies.
Yeah, plenty of bodies to use as well with the people that have been sent back there. And he's saying that this film must have been shot right after these people have been shot. I guess he must have known what these bodies looked like during the war. But maybe the people back home that were being shown this propaganda, they weren't likely to pick up on that.
No.
And there's that allegation there that it is the Russians that were doing it, because a lot of the Holocaust propaganda was manufactured by the Russians. There's a book, I think, The Holocaust Manufactured in Russia or something, that goes through a lot of these pictures and a lot of this false evidence.
I think the overall picture has to be understood that the bankers controlled Russia from the Russian Revolution. So anything what was going on in Russia was also the knowledge of the US and London bankers.
Definitely. And then he's obviously talking to a jailer. He says, the Colonel Jailer ought to bear in mind that he is dealing with historical figures here. Right or wrong, we are historical personalities, and he is nobody. So he's obviously not being treated with the respect that he deserves.
No, I'm obviously somebody thinking above the station.
Yeah, it's important that they, I mean, we don't look at it this way now, but it's important to remember the offices of people and the class that they were in. I mean, we're told that everybody's just equal now, but that's not the way we used to be. We used to look up to people that were in the upper classes or in the aristocracy with good reason. And whether they were members of an army that you'd just been fighting against or not, they would still be treated as if they were that officer. Like when the...
Yes, it's a civilized way.
Yeah, when the prisoners of war were arrested, the officers would still be officers, and the privates would still be privates, and they would be treated as they were officers. They would be treated as equals, especially in the Air Force. This was this is probably the first time that this had actually happened.
Well, this is a trait of this particular Talmudic British Empire. These are the first not to recognize these things. Like I said, after World War One, they were still a blockade, starving the Germans, which nobody knew about because of the media blackout. So there's no real morals at all to this kind of empire. Probably the worst, even worse than, say, Genghis Khan, because even after the war, even today, this genocide, slow, secret genocide of a certain race, is continuing. Pure evil.
Well, I think it also shows that was the way that the Germans treated people. They would have treated them with respect. They would have treated them with the respect that their class deserved. Otherwise, he wouldn't be expecting it himself from this jailer and from the court.
I suppose you could go back to Hitler saying, we won't surrender because we know what will happen if we do surrender. He was always familiar with the fact that he thought this was an ideology war, and at the end of the day, that's different to a different kind of war. This is a fight to the death and an extermination of the defeated. Hitler understood this.
Well, yeah, he retained the moral upper ground and didn't want to stoop to the level of the Allies and the behaviour of the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that with the court-martials for the mistreatment of prisoners and all these rules that the German soldiers had. They weren't to get involved in any looting. They weren't to steal anything these other soldiers. And yet when the Allies came in, they were stealing all the Germans' watches and breaking all these general rules, civilized rules that we'd had for centuries. I mean, we used to have these rules of chivalry that went back to when knights were fighting and before that to Roman times, and there were rules of war that were always observed. I mean, they were
especially surrounding civilians.
Yeah, well, they would camp up for battles. They'd arrange when they're going to meet for a battle, and they'd camp up on either side. They'd finish at a certain time. There was areas where two could meet, and there wouldn't be a battle between them. If a prince or a nobleman was caught, then he would be treated in a certain way. There was all these just laws of chivalry that had grown for centuries that were just thrown out of the window at the end of this war. As if they we just didn't need to observe them as far as the Germans were concerned. And it was all those laws that made us human.
Yeah, it's just sprung to mind the Nuremberg trials, very similar to the trials of Saddam. Saddam was put on trial.
Yeah, well, it set the standard ever since then. But it was these things that set us apart from the other races. I mean, these are like what makes us civilized. Is the way that we treat our enemies and those that are different to us, but not now, not in the last 75 years after this war. And then he makes quite a wry comment here. He says the only allies who are still allied are the four prosecutors, and they are only allied against the 20 defendants. Yeah. So this is at the end of the war, and you've still got this group pretending that the war is still going, and they're the prosecutors, and they're prosecuting him, but it's all over. What was the point in having this?
Plus, they're well aware of the atrocities caused by the Allies, especially the rapes of the 2 million German women by the Russians. There's a Russian judge there. Obviously, the French and the British have played the part. And so it's kind of a mockery of a trial.
Yeah, the so-called victims are standing there in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this was supposed to be unbiased justice, then it would have been judges from some country that had played no part in the war that were standing there.
Well, you've got the judges giving verdicts on actions that their own countries had already perpetrated.
Yeah. War crimes that they were accusing the other of, that they themselves were guilty of.
They'd all committed, yeah.
But they weren't war crimes for them because they were the victorious allies.
Yeah, that's right.
They had won. So it's kind of like kicking someone when he's down, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and like I said, the kicking still goes on.
And again, that's another one of these rules. You know, if somebody's down on the ground, you don't then continue to attack them. It's just like the rules of civilization. Like if somebody wears spectacles, you're not supposed to attack them,
mm-hmm.
because it's not an even fight. You know, we always had this way of looking at things that think things had to be even. We had to try and make them as even
level
as
playing
possible.
Field. Yeah,
level playing field. So it's all things to do with being white. What's the next bit he says? This is a political trial by the victors. And it will be a good thing for Germany when they realise that. And that's what you were pointing to earlier, Dennis, mm-hmm. that he was expecting the Germans to see this and revolt, which is, of course, that's why they've got these laws today that you can't, in Germany, you can't question the outcome of the Nuremberg trials because they don't want people to look into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't want people to look into it because they realise that it was a kangaroo court. And the judgment at the end of it was not a judgment. It was an indictment of the people that were claiming to be making the judgment. And it should be enough for
a similar
revolution.
To banning of using his name after the war, which I also covered, when he couldn't even speak the name Adolf Hitler. So there's no way you can defend it.
Who was that couldn't speak the name? Oh,
the Germans.
In America. Yeah, yeah. They used... Yeah. Something else that they said for him, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it was USA, which was in German, meant our sacred Arulf.
Right. He says, I still don't recognise the authority of the court. Bringing the heads of a sovereign state before a foreign court is a piece of presumption which is unique in history. Again, that's just stating that this is a travesty of justice. But again, these are the people, don't forget, these are the people that killed Charles I. That thought that they could somehow put the king in the court. Again, this goes to where the whole idea of law comes from and justice. It's called the crown because you've got one person at the top, you've got the king, and he dispenses the justice, and the king makes the laws, and the laws have to be in attune with God's laws. But there's nobody actually above the king but God. So you can't.
There's no God.
Yeah, but so they're taking away the meaning of God now, but that's why you can't take a king to court.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is right at the top, which they did, and they had no authority to do that. That's the thing. It's the authority. It's only the king that has the authority to enforce the law, or the government under the king has the authority to enforce the law. Who has the authority to enforce the law over the heads of another sovereign state? They don't have mm-hmm. that authority. They should have been
in the case of Iraq with Saddam.
Yeah, well, they hadn't broken any laws because they're the people that make the laws legally and lawfully according to their constitution. The National Socialists were voted into power. Everything was done legally. This wasn't a criminal gang like in the Soviet Union that were just taken over. They were mm-hmm. legitimately voted in. The laws they made were legitimate laws, and they fought a defensive war, and then they were treated as if they'd broken laws which didn't exist. Which never existed.
Sounds about right.
He says, yes, I still maintain my loyalty to the Führer in difficult times as well as in good. So he's refusing to back down.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, I didn't cut a pretty figure, did I? Don't forget I had the best legal brains of England, America, Russia and France arrayed against me with the whole legal machinery. And there was I, alone. Do you think about that as well? They hardly had a good defence. They weren't allowed to use any defence. And he wasn't allowed to even read out his prepared defence.
No, well, according to this American in the documentary, he kind of says that he held his own. There's no doubt about it.
I think that's probably what he's referring to there. Mm-hmm. I think all reports say that, don't they?
Yeah.
That he did well. I'd like to read, I think David Irving's got a big book on Göring. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have a read of that one day. Then he says, mass murder. I assure you, we never for a moment had such things in mind. I only thought we would eliminate Jews from positions in big business and government. And that was all. But don't forget that the Jews carried on a terrific campaign against us too, all over the world. So again, there's two things there. And he's saying eliminate Jews from positions, not eliminate Jews, as in exterminate Jews, but remove them from big business and government, and reminding the court that it was the Jews that declared war on Germany, and the economic boycott, and the campaign that they waged against them all over the world. So quite rightly, they saw Jews as enemy agents within their country.
I found out today, only today, by the way, they declared war on Germany in 1933 with this holy war. They actually declared war on Germany in 1939.
What was the 1939 one?
It was a reassurance, a letter to London to reassure they will do their utmost to fulfill what they needed to do with the British army. But it was another declaration of war.
You know, you got Britain declares war against Germany, and then if British are found in Germany, they would expect to be locked up and put in a camp. And you've got Jews that also declare war against Germany, and yet somehow it's wrong of Germany to lock those Jews up and put them in a camp. They were belligerent agents, enemy agents. They were the enemy within the country that they were actually at war with, and this enemy was in every other country too.
No difference about the Japanese had in America. You know, Roosevelt rounded up all the Japanese American citizens, so to speak, and put them all in camps. No different.
Well, yeah, and it's no different against the people that were fighting in the war. You know, they don't make a big fuss about all the Poles that were killed or all the British that were killed. It just make a fuss about the Jews that were killed, as if the Jews were something special and something different, when in actual fact they were, you know, they were one of the forces that were fighting against Germany, but from also within Germany, and also controlling governments everywhere else in the world. They may not have had their own specific Jewish army, but they had Jews that were aiding the war effort against Germany everywhere and from within. And it admits that in that Wikipedia bit where it says that when Goering was going after the partisans, he killed so many Jews.
Well, you've got to remember as well that all the high-ranking officials of the Allies were all Freemasons, and Freemasonry is a tool of Judah.
Well, they don't make so much fuss about him getting rid of the Freemasons now, do they? They try to really hide that, I think.
Yeah, there's been no, from what I can remember, no mention of any historian going down that road.
Yeah, there's no monuments to the lost Freemasons in the Second World War.
But I also know that, you know, the feeling of Freemasonry is that they will be sacrificed at the end anyway. And when you look at Libya, where Gaddafi is believed to be a Freemason, and you look at South Africa in the Boer War, when high-ranking South Africans were also Freemasons, then they think nothing of turning on Freemasonry. And, you know, eventually that is what is predicted with the Radinsky interview, you know, with Stalin's guy.
Yeah, I think they did the same in the USSR, didn't they? Once they'd actually taken power.
Yes, they did.
They had no more need for them. And again, he brought up this loyalty idea. He said, I wanted to set my people an example that loyalty was not dead. See, what he's saying is your ideals are more important. That's what's more important, is setting a good example and showing that even though the Führer is dead, he still has loyalty to him.
Well, lots of the laws in Germany were all about honour and loyalty. You know, this is stipulated in you know, these like in the SS, you know, the actual, you know, what's the word I'm looking for joining them. You've got to stipulate these speeches and
the oath.
That's what Germany were all about.
The oath, well, loyalty and honor, all these things were so important to our people. I mean, I've mentioned it a few times. I've been reading the history of the Danes, the Book of the Danes, and right the way through that, it teaches you basically the aspects of character that we thought were the most important, and it's all courage, honor, loyalty, death before dishonor, and that's what Goering was exhibiting here, this death before dishonor idea, and that was more important, and that would mean that he lived on after his death. The tales would still be told about him. So we're talking about him still today. So we're talking about Adolf Hitler still today, because they knew that it was your actions that were more important than anything else.
Well, a perfect example of how things have changed is that once over in Britain, you could shake someone's hand and that would be a binding honour between the two people. But, you know, that rarely stands today. I mean, to chance a contract on a shake of a hand today, you'd be quiet. You know, wouldn't be recommended.
Well, the handshake goes back 2,000-3,000 years. The idea of the contract, and I mean, they always used to say a man is only as good as his word.
That's right.
You keep your word. If you don't keep your word, and your word is valueless, then you have no value as a man. You can't be relied upon. It all goes to keeping your word, basically, and expecting God to keep his word. That's what faith is, faith in the promise of God that it's not going to be broken, and we're supposed to emulate that, and we're supposed to keep our word. It's more important than anything else. That's why they had these oaths. You would take an oath to God that God would punish you if you broke your word. And all the people, all the officers of state are built around taking these oaths, and we trust them to keep their word. But we've encouraged them not to believe in God anymore. So there's no punishment if they do break their word. So what do? They break their word, and we get corruption. Lies.
Yeah, exactly.
And he says, what the American-controlled newspapers print now in Germany does not count for anything.
Yeah, interesting that, because they would have took over the press straight away. And they're not necessarily Americans, as we know.
Yeah, they did. They took it all over. And what they did then, they allowed people, they sort of gave contracts to people to take over it. E. Michael Jones has done a lot of work on this. What they did after the denazification with these like American Jewish companies that then owned the publishing, they then put all this pornography in there and all this degenerate stuff and tried to just turn the German people immoral, basically, and encourage extramarital sex and abortion and all this degenerate stuff was being pushed in Germany first before it was pushed outside Germany to the rest of Europe.
Interestingly enough, I watched a documentary the other day on the early Beatles, and when they went to Hamburg, and it showed just exactly what Hamburg was. I mean, just a rebuilt version of what Berlin was before Hitler took over. And of course, you know, prostitutes and every other state of sexual arousal is there for the Beatles to enjoy.
And of course, one of the National Socialist laws, may even have been one of the 25 principles, was that the newspapers can only be owned by Germans. It has to be Germans that produce them, because they knew how important it was to have the control of the media. And of course, today, just about all the media companies, or all the people at the top of the media companies, it's all owned by Jews.
Yeah, CIA infiltrated.
And that's a euphemism there. What the American-controlled newspapers print now in Germany? Yeah, that was the CIA. It was the CIA that were responsible for all of them, basically.
Yeah,
giving out franchises and saying who could make magazines and who couldn't. It was all down to the CIA. Testing out testing out what they learned from Kinsey and all the flawed sexology research that he had done. They then put that into practice in the mainstream media over there in Germany. And then there's a comment here. I think he's talking to another field marshal. He says, "It is no use complaining, field marshal. These people do not have our breeding. They don't understand these things. It is just as I have always told you." So again, this is an ancient tradition of breeding, and that it's where you come from that matters. Going back to that Book of the Danes, another thing that becomes apparent in that more important than your actual deeds is your breeding. That they've got somebody in there and he carries out all these courageous acts and then he proposes to the princess or whatever, and she won't have it because he doesn't have the breeding. And that's shown as the example that people should follow. Mm-hmm. The nobles should not marry peasants. Peasants should stay with peasants. Nobles should stay with nobles. I guess warriors should stay with the warrior caste. As I was saying, Göring was of this warrior caste. And that's why he's saying that they don't understand these things. So it's no use complaining to them. They won't even understand what it is you're complaining about.
Well, they don't have a frame of context for it. Because again, I watched a documentary on Joan of Arc, who was a peasant girl, who said that she'd been spoken to by God and to demand to lead an army against the English at a siege, which had been going on for years. And when she took the army over and led the siege, it was over in 4 days. And that was classed as a miracle because she was a peasant and had no right to be actually doing anything on this level. But yeah, I understand what you're saying, which makes it a miracle.
Yeah, it does. And then what they would do today is they would hold that up and say, oh, all women can do it. Women can do whatever they wish to do or whatever. When it's not, it's the exception to the rule. It doesn't mean there is no rule. It means that is the exception to the rule. And there are always exceptions to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
Got a longer quote here next. He says, "No wonder you can't find any people with real leadership to take the responsibilities of administration in Germany. Do you know why? Because the best nationalist leaders are in jail, and the rest figure that if they carry out the denazification laws now, who knows but that in 10 years after America leaves, or a fight between East and West changes the situation, they will be brought before a German national court and tried for treason. And what do the German people think? I've already told you. Whenever things are lousy, we have democracy. Make no mistake about it. The people know that they were better off when Hitler was in power before the war. And don't forget that Hitler was more than just a person to us. The next generation is finding its own leaders, and they will fight for the protection of their own national interests. So you can take your morality and your repentance and your democracy and peddle it elsewhere." Very truthful.
Very yeah, truthful. And I think the Allies would have known exactly what he was saying, which is probably why they've dumbed down Germany to the extent they have, and they probably used underhanded techniques to do it.
Well, yeah, they knew that they had a real struggle, and that's why they had this full-spectrum domination of everything with this denazification. That's why they put all these falsehoods into the camps and these shrunken heads and the skin lampshades, and knew that they would have to bring all the people in there, pretend that all the dead bodies from starvation from the Allied bombing, pretend that that was caused by the Germans.
Change
all the teachers. Locked up everybody that had anything whatsoever to do with National Socialism was locked up at first, and then they put these Jews in charge. Basically, the Jews that have gone to America were able to come back, the ones that spoke German, and they were put in charge of everything.
Took revenge.
And he's got the idea here that there's going to be a fight between East and West as well.
Yeah, well, that's possibly because of the Stalin thing. When Stalin turned, but after Stalin was murdered, then things got back under control for the bankers again.
Yeah, but he knew that the West was going to have to fight against Bolshevism. Mm. He knew that that was eventually going to have to happen. And a lot of the National Socialist scientists, I mean, they went off with Operation Paperclip to work with the Americans, because the Americans knew that's what was going to happen. They were basically on the wrong side in the war. Britain was on the wrong side in the war. America was on the wrong side in the war.
Yeah, well, that's because of the bankers, because the bankers control the government. I mean, Roosevelt worked for the bankers, Stalin worked for the bankers, so
yeah,
controlling both sides. Which is why Patton was murdered, because Patton didn't see it.
Yeah, it's like occasionally there were people that actually saw what was really going on, and they were neutralised, weren't they? Like Oswald Mosley.
I think Patton wrote back to his wife in letters to say that if we don't act now, then communism will infiltrate America. I don't think he realised Roosevelt was already in there and one of the leading purveyors of it.
And I think when he's saying here, you can take your morality and your repentance and your democracy and peddle it elsewhere, he's not saying that he's immoral. What he's saying is that the morality that the Allies have is not a morality that he would ever be able to uphold himself, because it's immoral.
Yeah.
He's not saying that he's immoral. He's saying that the morality of the Allies has been inversed, which it has been. We see the end result of that now, with homosexuality being taught to children and homosexuals pretending to be the guardians of morality.
Yeah, and 30 different types of gender and all this.
Yeah,
but also in Hong Kong at the moment, a lot of people are coming out speaking against the Hong Kong government, saying that we want democracy, but they're unaware of what democracy really is. You know, it's just one step to socialism and another step to communism.
It's hilarious when they're waving American flags and the BBC are saying, oh, the American flag has become a short term for freedom, that they're signalling freedom. They're signalling who it is that's paying their wages, who it is that's sponsoring this fake revolution over there. There's been Pepe symbols as well that have been seen. Mm-hmm. But obviously not a major part of this. It's just a fake revolution that's going on over there, the same as the one in Libya and in Syria and in Ukraine and all over the place. I did a podcast with Dr. Johnson on that. Mm-hmm. Got another quote from him here. Those who kowtowed to the prosecution and denounced the Nazi regime got it in the neck just the same, and it serves them right. So even the ones that did lie and caved in, whether it was through threatening of their family or smashing of their testicles or whatever to get a false confession out of them, they were still killed just the same.
Well, they would be, because, like I say, and as you know, it's about race. I mean, you know, the Russian leader said, you know, told the troops to wipe out this Germanic line by raping all the women in Germany. And so these people who were, you know, traitors in a way to their own country were always going to get eliminated because they're the same race.
Well, they should have stuck to the truth and accepted that what was going to happen. That would have been the noble and honourable thing to do. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of people on the alt-right and the civic nationalists that are, you know, that will denounce the white nationalists. They'll denounce the real far right and the real racists and the real white supremacists. And they still get called Nazis. They still get called all those names. They can, they try and point at us and say, oh, they're the real fascists over there. We're not fascists. And they still get called it. And they just end up arguing with the Antifa over who's the real fascist instead of actually, you know, talking about anything of any relevance. And it's exactly the same thing here. You know, ignoring the truth, denouncing the truth, and they're still going to get treated just the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Got a final quote here. He says, I'm glad that it is not a life sentence because those who are sentenced to life imprisonment never become martyrs. So again, he knew,
it's true, isn't it?
Knew the importance of this, of the symbology of him being executed and how unjust it was, and that the symbol of this, that the symbolism of it is that they would be seen as martyrs.
Yeah, it was interesting a couple of weeks ago when we did the podcast on Himmler's daughter, because for many years, you know, it's a mystery of how he actually got his poison and was saved the noose. And apparently it came from one of the guards. The guards had obviously been, you know, at the court and obviously felt some sympathy for him and saved him the disgrace of being hung like a criminal.
Well, I think there was sympathies for him, because you can read from some of the reports from the people that were in the court that were saying, this is a kangaroo court. You've got Jews that are there as officers. You've got Jews as marshals of the court. You've got Jews as judges, Jews as translators. And it's just, you know, them getting their own back. And there were people in the court that wrote that. I've got a David Irving book on the Nuremberg trials, which is particularly interesting.
The problem is to the ordinary man in the street, they look at that like they were put on trial and they were investigated, found to be guilty and sentenced accordingly. And the ordinary man in the street is led to believe that this was an above official trial. And that there comes the deceit.
Well, yeah, they don't think any further, do they? I think that's why they had this trial. I think at the time, a lot of people knew that it was wrong. But if you say to people today, now we've had the dumbing down of our education and people don't really think about these things, and you say, well, it was unjust, and they'll say, oh, yes, but they were tried in a court at the end of the war and they were found guilty. So they were found to have been guilty. Just the fact that to actually try heads of state after a war in another country is totally above all laws, doesn't really occur to them.
Yeah, there's a quote, I think, from an English judge, and maybe an American one as well, to say that when they come back, they really didn't want any part of this because it was, as you said, a kangaroo court. But then again, Hollywood didn't take long to start making, you know, the movie, and so another few million people saw the version. and we're convinced again, you know.
Right, and then you've got the laws saying that you're not allowed to question the judgment. I mean, especially in Germany, that's what their Holler Hoax law is. Anything that came out of that Nuremberg court, to actually doubt that or question it or suggest that something else might have happened, that's punishable by law, including the Kachin massacre, which was blamed on the Germans, which has come out since then that actually, yes, the Germans were right. It was all carried out by the Russians because that was part of the Nuremberg judgment. That's Holocaust denial to point out that fact in Germany.
Yeah, plus the fact Roosevelt and Churchill knew about it, as it was shown in the documentary, The Greatest Story. But they never actually, I mean, the press mentioned that the Russians were found to be guilty of the Katyn, but they never exactly exonerated Hitler for doing it, although that, in a sense, did exonerate him.
Yeah, posthumously exonerated, but you can't actually say that in Germany. I mean, when that happened, the Germans were saying, look, we've found like this massacre and we want UN inspectors or League of Nations inspectors to come and check all this out to see what's gone on here.
They got some people from neutral countries, I think, like Sweden, to go there and show them exactly what happened. But again, the control of the press, you know, very few people got to know about it outside of Europe.
Well, these are all interesting quotes that we've got here, and he says there at the end that he's going to be made glad he's going to be made into a marcher because he's going to be killed. But Rudolf Hess wasn't a marcher; he wasn't killed, and yet he's still honoured as a hero. And we'll have a look at some of his quotes next week, I think, Dennis.
Yeah, well, the slight difference is that he was hung at the end, but you know, people think he could be a suicide, which would be difficult for a man of his age.
Yeah, good point there. Officially he committed suicide, but rather like the Epstein one, wasn't it?
Not very really much so.
A way for him to do it. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on, Dennis.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you. ¶¶